Governor Scott uses veto pen on a big education bill. Speaking of education, the Duval County School Board has named an interim superintendent. And Moody's gives Jacksonville's pension reform plan a mixed review. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen anytime there or on iTunes. Stream us live now on our Facebook page and call in. With the top stories of the week about to kick off with our rockin' Friday Media Roundtable. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, park the car and hop on your bike. It's Bike to Work Day. We'll tell you all about it. And artist Jeffrey Locke. All of that and more ahead. But first, it's Friday and time for our weekly roundtable as we welcome Florida Times Union columnist Ron Littlepage. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning.
Claire Goforth, editor of Folio Weekly, is here.
Good morning.
Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
And WJCT's own reporter, Lindsay Kilbride.
Hello, good to be here.
So good to see you all and lots to discuss this Friday. Everything from a new interim superintendent for Jacksonville to health problems for the new CEO of CSX and more. But our top story right now, public school officials around the state are speaking out against a controversial education bill on the governor's desk. They're pressuring Rick Scott to veto this measure. Now, it includes dozens of different policies affecting K through 12 education, but the big pieces are a $234 million bonus package for teachers and some principals, and a really controversial line item, a $140 million Schools of Hope program. Now, this would provide more incentives to privately managed charter schools. Thursday on First Coast Connect, we discussed the bill with Duval County School Board member Becky Couch, and she told us why she thinks the governor should veto this. Take a listen.
There are some good parts to this bill, but I don't think you have to put all of those in one bill with some garbage, too, that could really be detrimental to traditional public school students.
Okay. The number to join us to let us know what you think about whether or not Governor Scott should veto this bill. Do you think he should or shouldn't, and why? Give us a call, 549-2937. Lindsay Kilbride, let's begin with you. You cover education for WJCT, and this education bill is getting heavy lobbying right now. People flooding the governor's office with pleas to veto, and also supporters encouraging him to pass it. Let's explain why this is so controversial.
So it's controversial for one reason, because at the very end of session, a couple lawmakers got together during budgeting session and basically meshed together all these bills in this like massive train bill with a lot of different elements in it, some that had been passed and some new language. And so, you know, even Governor Scott, who was in town this week, mentioned that a lot of this was done in secret. However, Jason Fisher, the representative who used to be a Duval County School Board member, who is also a proponent of a lot of this, you know, he says, you know, a lot of this stuff has already been discussed, that it wasn't done in secret. So that's just one element, but there's a lot of different things in it. So you mentioned mm-hmm. Schools of Hope. There's also capital funding, which is a really big deal in Duval County because our schools are so old. So, you know, I think it's like 50% of our schools are 60 years or older. It's something like that. They're just really old schools. So we need funding to do just things like major, minor maintenance, like new roofs, new walkway coverings, things like that. And charter schools don't have to adhere to a lot of the same standards traditional public schools do. Like, they don't have to double as a hurricane shelter. There's like things like that where mm-hmm. Traditional public schools may need those extra money. This would require Duval County to share their levy tax dollars that are for capital projects with charter schools. So they're very worried about that. They don't think they'll have enough money. They have $120 million backlog of just projects like roof replacements, things like that.
549-2937. It's really striking, the division over this. Ron Littlepage, columnist for the Florida Times Union. Advocates of this bill say this is giving the charter school world a more level playing field. Traditional public school advocates say, no, this is slowly dismantling traditional public education by siphoning more and more tax dollars away.
I would go with the latter. I think that's been the trend in Florida for a number of years now. And this is going to be interesting. The the governor's not happy with the legislature. We're not dealing with his priorities. And if he's looking for something to veto, this might very well be the bill. However, on the other hand, he is a proponent of school choice and is getting ready to run for Senate, which that is something he probably would take into consideration.
That's right. There are a lot of political considerations weighing on Rick Scott. Claire, Tim?
There is that idea of the he does like charter schools, and I think in some ways he is looking to make a point, but how he does the calculus on this is it will be interesting to see.
Yeah, how does this affect his Senate race? How angry is he at the legislature for torpedoing his big priorities, Visit Florida and Enterprise Florida, the agencies promoting tourism and economic development?
Yeah, this is his opportunity, really, to get back at Corcoran for supporting, you know, dismantling
House Speaker.
Enterprise Florida. I do think that, you know, what are we going to do if we do move towards all charter schools and we dismantle the public school system? These charter school companies, typically a lot of them are out of state. Some of them are even owned distantly by foreign corporations. So if a charter school company closes and then the school abruptly closes, what is the fallback if we have a situation where there's just not enough public schools left to shift all the students over? Then we'll find ourselves with students with nowhere to go, scrambling to make up this ground and find a place for the students to get an education.
It's 549-2937. Let us know what you think. Lindsay?
I think that's something that local school board members are concerned about. We have quite a few schools here that have had, you know, D's and F's. And what this legislation would do would give schools less time, basically, to turn that school around, get it up to a C. And then if the school doesn't turn around, there's a few different options, but they all sort of involve closing the school down. So it's closing the school down and rerouting the kids. And then a charter could open up within 5 miles of that school. But there are a lot of different things that the board members are concerned about. Like, for instance, the charter school doesn't have to provide transportation, so it might be on the school board to provide that, or they'd have to reroute the kids to other schools. So they're like, are these kids going to be bused like across town? They're worried that a lot of these schools are going to be closing in the same area. And then the thing is, the charter school that can come in has to be what's called has a good track record. And so what our school board members are arguing is that just because a charter school company has a good track record doesn't mean all their charter schools are well performing. And it really has more to do with like the teachers you have in place, the principals, mm-hmm. just the team that you build there, not necessarily mm-hmm. this company name. And then one of their examples is Kipp Charter School, which has a really good track record. It's a national charter school company. We have a couple here in Jacksonville, and you know, one has a D grade. And the argument is that they face the same challenges that other schools in the same area may face.
Right. Running up against socioeconomic factors in a poor neighborhood, if you're not looking at the child's whole situation, how much can a private company do that the public school can't?
I think that's the point, and Kipp is a good example of that. They've struggled with a D grade, and then I think you're up to a C in the middle school now. But think of the extra resources Kipp has had to try to get to that point. If those same kind of resources were available in public schools, you probably would have the same results. But the overall problem, you're right, how do you deal with the socioeconomic problems that the community has that the schools really can't cure?
Now, it's been pointed out to us, too, on this program as we discussed this all week, Claire. Overall, around the state, according to some metrics anyway, charter schools are slightly outperforming public schools. However, here in Duval County, they're very much not outperforming traditional public schools, and we've had some closures with more probably in the pipeline. So in Duval County especially, this is being watched really closely.
Yeah, I mean, Duval County is certainly a unique county among other Floridian counties. We just have a lot of things that isolate us from the rest of Florida. I do wonder whether or not these charter schools, you know, if it's really good for students over time to be funneling public money into private companies. And then you look at this over $200 million for the raises for teachers, those performance-based raises. If we took some of that money and put that money into our public school system, it arguably could make it easier for these failing schools to improve. Because, I mean, we've been pouring money into the testing system and charter schools for many years, and that money, you take from one area to give money to another. And that means that these public schools, they just don't have the resources. I mean, I heard that the funding rate right now is lower than it was at the height of the recession for public schools.
And Tim Gibbons, our business editor, the charter school perspective is coming at this from a business point of view. Let's apply the principles of free enterprise to education. That has, let's apply choice and competition. And that is the controversy.
That is the idea. And the idea is that if you let the free market work and try different ideas, that the best ideas will come out. The flip side of that, though, is if you're doing it to make money, you have different choices. You know, charter schools are accused of basically moving students who are not doing as well, kind of, you know, easing them out of the process, putting them back into the public school system, which now has, you know, like the insurance risk pools. You have public schools that have students who truly have performance issues. Is the charter school doing better because they're actually teaching better, or are they just better at managing basically who their customers are?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I spoke with Jason Fisher a couple times about this. I spoke to him on the phone once, and I sent him some questions and got some feedback, and he totally disagrees. You know, he is basically saying that we need to do something completely different, that this is the answer, that he says it's data, you know, that there's a lot of data behind it. And I think his reasoning mostly is that the charter schools have to have a good track record. And that's sort of what he told me was, you know, if they're good performing charter, well-performing charter schools, they're going to do well here. And he was basically just saying, we have failing schools. We need to do something completely different. I think our school board members in Duval County, they kind of feel like a lot of like the teacher bonuses and the recess, that's
yeah, this measure mandates recess for all public
for charter schools. Charter schools can opt out, but basically, you know, there's been a big push among parents to have 20 minutes of recess a day of free
play. A lot
of
schools aren't doing that, yeah, because they're focusing on testing, right?
Yeah, and I mean, they have structured play and they have PE already, so they also want them to have recess every day. So anyway, that's something that's in the bill, and the school board members are sort of saying that it's kind of a cover. It's kind of like a nice way to dress it up, and then you have all these other things that might negatively impact the district, and that's how they're feeling.
Ron Littlepage.
Well, let me go ahead and prove I'm very cynical.
that's no, shocking. Ron. I'm shocked to hear this.
You know, I think it, a while back, some people looked and saw how much money was going into the public school systems, and they said, we want some of that. And these charter school companies started coming up and taking money away from the public schools. I don't think it's so much altruism as it is they want to make money off of it. And I find really interesting about Jason Fisher, go back and look at his campaign contributions and see who he's getting money from and why he's spouting that line.
You know, if we can get this kind of money out of public schools, why not out of the prison system? Yeah. Oh, wait, we're doing that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, these private companies are basically just seeing, like Ron says, an opportunity to enrich themselves on the public dollar.
All right, let's go to some calls. Do you think the governor should veto or pass this legislation? 549-2937. Joshua on the south side. Hi, Joshua. Good morning.
Good morning. I was just curious, what actually makes them show where our public tax dollars go? I'm under the impression that charter schools don't actually have to show where our public tax funds go once it goes to that private company.
Thanks for the question.
I think I understand.
That once they receive taxpayer funds, where's the oversight process on how those funds are being spent?
The Duval County School Board has a charter with them, so it's, you know, a contract with them. So, I mean, there isn't a lot of oversight, which I think is the big issue that the school board has, which is they can hire their own teachers, have their own curriculum, things like that. The other issue with, like, our tax dollars, our local property tax dollars that we're now going, if Governor Scott signs it, the district would now have to share with charter schools. One issue school board members have with it is that, you know, about half of their capital funding will be going to charter schools. Well, those people who, you know, it's a private company and they're enriching this building that they can just go ahead and sell, and it's not going to go back into the district. So that's another issue that they're seeing with it, which is, you know, we're just kind of giving people money, and then, you know, they also don't, like I said before, they don't have to adhere to the same building standards anyway. So like our schools have like actual safety standards that they have to comply with.
Without weighing in on the merits of it, it is a fascinating commercial real estate story of having these charter schools that are sometimes renting buildings. They get the money to do the improvements. charter school goes out of business, you now have a improved building, which, you know, arguably could be good for the real estate economy and other players.
Yeah, good for there is actually a hurricane, and a lot of the schools are no longer hurricane shelters. I mean, that could actually be a public safety issue.
Oh, hurricanes don't hit Jacksonville.
Okay, Elena in Jacksonville Beach. Go ahead, Elena.
I just wanted to mention that charter schools don't have to follow any sort of disability laws or have IEPs or file those course for kids that I know of, and the public schools do. And I'm not talking about segregated disability schools. Like, I think there's charter schools strictly for autistic kids. I'm talking about kids with a disability that are in the classroom with a typical kid. So that's a lot of funding that goes to that. And, you know, I think if we're going to open more charter schools, we need to make these charter schools help our kids with high-functioning disabilities.
Thanks for that. Here's an email saying pretty much the same. A wealth of longitudinal data shows charters do not outperform traditional schools, even though charters tend not to serve students with special needs. John, professor of education at UNF. So this idea that charters can sort of cherry pick their student population.
And then how are the public schools supposed to improve? Because the charter schools have cherry-picked all of the students who have this academic gifts, whose parents are highly involved. It leaves behind students who may not be as academically gifted or may not be as good at testing or whose parents are just not as motivated to be involved in their child's education. So arguably, the students left behind in the public schools, they may be surrounded by a peer group that really isn't reflective of the society as a whole.
Okay.
And I would just say that not all charter schools do that. I know that, you know, there are some big issues with them doing that, but I've definitely visited charter schools that have, you know, a mix of kids. But I think the other thing is that, you know, it's sort of like, you know, parents who are more involved, who can give their kids transportation, you know, that's another issue, which is that most charter schools don't provide transportation. So when that comes into play, that sort of also can segregate students.
Janet on the West Side. Go ahead, Janet.
Hi. I just wanted to say I worked at a school for a project last year, and it would be nice if Duval County would invest in our high schools, because this high school had no library and no computers for the students to work on and to do their homework. So they were really disadvantaged, and that's just not fair. They said they were going to get them, but they never got them.
Thank you, Janet, for that. Ron?
Well, a lot of times it comes down to resources, and if you're draining your money for charter schools, you don't have the resources for your public schools.
I would say that, you know, that sort of goes hand in hand with capital funding. The capital funding, the local levy tax dollars, and some of the bonds they've taken out, they can be used for building projects and enhancements on buildings, but also technology. And our district has had a really big push to get computers. I don't know if the ultimate goal is one-to-one, but I know, like, I think at middle schools, they're almost one-to-one, and they're getting there. But if they have to share their capital dollars with tax money, their capital dollars with charter schools, they're not going to be able to, you know, update the computers. You know, I think every 5 years or so, they have to do replacements and things like that. That's what they're worried about. They're not going to be able to keep up with what they have already. And that's, you know, not even talking about improving it.
Wow. Lots of calls on this. Benjamin on the South Side. Go ahead, Benjamin.
Hi there. I just wanted to call and talk to a comment about that one of the presenters made. They were talking about fact that it's kind of a money grab from a charter school perspective. I kind of take umbrage with that, because at the end of the day, they're still a business. If they're not doing well for the kids, the parents won't send their children there. The difference between a charter school and a public school is that if you're in a bad public school district, you don't have a choice to send your kids somewhere else unless you want to go to a very expensive private school. If you're in a charter school, you can go to a different charter school. You can go to a public school. You have a lot more choice. If the school isn't performing the way they're supposed to be performing, you have the ability to take your tax dollars elsewhere. I think that's the core behind most people's support of this.
Yeah, thank you, Benjamin. That's the argument. Yeah. The parents are demanding choice.
Well, our district... Oh, sorry, were you...
No. Tim.
Sorry, I didn't mean.
Lindsay.
Our district has been really pro-school choice for a while now. Like, we've basically had open... So, okay, this next school year, open enrollment is like the... law of the land in Florida. So any kid can go to any school in Florida if there's space for them, and they don't, but transportation isn't provided. But in Duval County, we've already been doing that. Like, we have a school choice office that helps students basically go to any school they want to, as long as there's space for them there. And that's about to be the rule of the land, the law of the land. So I think he's right, but I think that we've already been doing that in Duval County. And that's our superintendent's argument, is that, mm-hmm. you know, we already give a lot of choice to students, and like, just help us improve that.
Nicolai Vitti, who is making tracks on I-75, actually, not I-95, as he heads up to Michigan to take a new job. Let's talk about that, what the public school administrators are doing to try to meet the needs of parents. Because also making headlines this week, the Duval County School Board unanimously voted Wednesday to hire Patricia Willis. She has a 35-year history with the district as temporary superintendent. Willis is a Jacksonville native. She's been a teacher, principal, deputy superintendent, and she will run the school district until the board can find a permanent replacement for Nicolai Vitti, who is, of course, taking the superintendent's job in Detroit. Willis says she's up to the challenge.
I will always be committed to Duval County. I never imagined that I would serve in this role after retirement, but I am so honored and humbled that I've been asked to do it. So I'm just so excited right now.
Ann Willis saying she's going to continue the direction that Nicolai Vitti has set for the school district, in particular trying to offer more competitive programs for parents that are looking at charter schools. That's one of the things he did.
Basically, she was saying, I'm not going to make any drastic changes right now because that wouldn't be a smart thing to do. We're having somebody else come in, and, you know, hopefully 5-6 months is what the school board is envisioning, but who knows. But she's saying, you know, they're going to probably make a lot of changes. I'm just sort of here to keep,
keep the lights on.
Yes.
Just to back up a little bit for the last conversation, but this ties into it, of one of the issues with that argument on charter school is that, well, parents can just choose a new one, is this idea that change in education is difficult. You put your kid in a school, it doesn't work out. Okay, so the next year you go to a different school. It's not like, oh, you don't like going to public, so now you go to Harvey's. There's more to it. And so you have a new interim superintendent. She's not going to make any massive changes. New superintendent is going to come in. He or she's not going to make any massive changes for the first, you know, what, 6 months or something. So there is a slight amount of lack of acknowledgement of how slow the wheels of change can be in this situation.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to see the school board on the same page in regards to the superintendent for the first time in a long time. And I do think that it's very smart of them to choose someone who has such a, you know, lengthy history in Duval County and in the Duval County education system, so should be very familiar with all the players. But it will be interesting to see her navigate the potential ramifications of the state legislator's budget and how that could affect the school system.
Yes, she'll be asked to react to that right away.
Yeah, she's coming into a lot right now, which is what they were asking her about. And I mean, she basically said, they said, you know, we're in danger of closing down schools if this passes. What are you going to do? That was one of the questions one of them asked. And, you know, she basically just said, I will do everything in my power to go to the state and not have the schools closed down, which the school board has successfully done before. I think it was it Rebald and Raines and another. There were some schools in danger of closing a couple of years ago that they reversed. So she's basically saying, like, I'm going to put in all the resources I can and hopefully not have any schools closed down.
I think it's important to point out that the schools have already picked on, they're doing a bad job, et cetera, et cetera. They're also doing a really good job in a lot of areas. And I think Vitti had got us going in the right direction, so I think it's wise to stay going in that direction. At the Times Union, we sponsor an annual journalism contest for the schools. And when those kids come in there, you're impressed. So there's a lot of stuff going on that's good.
Mary in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Mary. Happy Friday. Go ahead.
Thank you. Two things. First of all, I just want to say that I strongly support strengthening the public school system versus undermining it. And the other thing I want to say is that in North Carolina, which I realize this is not here, an audit of the charter schools exposed that they are falsifying their results to make it look like they're doing better than they actually are. So that is a possibility, and they need much more scrutiny. The public schools are scrutinized heavily, and these schools barely at all. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. And, you know, this just gets down to two competing worldviews and whether you think the profit motive and the sort of business mindset should apply to education in this country, which traditionally it has not. And as we're seeing this shift, it's really striking. The feedback is pretty intense. And here's another email from Richard. The whole conversation of charter versus public schools comes down to a cultural problem with our profit incentive. I would bet any individual in any part of the charter system thinks they're doing well. Collectively, will this lead to bad results over time? That said, though, look at all the criticism of our public school system, which has led to these reforms in the first place.
And I think you can't overstate the idea that obviously the profit motive can twist things, but maybe it's, you know, covering business. I don't see that as a natural outcome. It's very possible to have people who want to do a good job who also want to make money out of it. Obviously, everybody knows that can go off the rails. I mean, you can see plenty of companies that do that, but you can also see plenty of entities that do good work, do good things, and have a profit motive behind them.
I think it's pretty obvious. Maybe not all the time, but there are definitely charter schools that open up in areas that are, okay, so, you know, charter schools only have a couple years to make a good grade before they're forced to close down, sort of like public schools. I mean, the school board argues that they have more time and it's not fair. And if they do better, then they shouldn't be given extra time. But so if a charter school opens up in an area where students are doing poorly and they're really trying to serve that demographic of students, to me, it becomes more obvious that they might have good intentions, because that's a lot harder for them to do. It's much easier for them to open up in Mandarin, for them to open up in the beaches, take kids from these overpopulated schools, and not have to do as much to turn the students around. They're already at a higher level. Not all the time, but mm-hmm. you know, if they're around schools that have an A school or something like that, then
there's more of a halo around, say, a KIPP school that opens up in the heart of the city than a charter school that opens up in a middle class zip code and is perceived, at least by some, as siphoning resources away from a middle class school. That's, is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, that's what it seems like.
All right, let's go to Megan at the beaches. Go ahead, Megan.
Hi. I just wanted to offer a different perspective. I'm planning to send my daughter to Seaside Community Charter next year, and although I respect the idea of investing in public school system, I think for parents who are in it right now and want their kids to have a better option than what we've seen in the public school system, I think these schools like Seaside that are Waldorf-inspired, have a lot of outdoor play, don't focus on testing, are good options for us. And I think it's poignant that these charter schools are maybe coming about because a lot of parents just aren't satisfied with putting their kids in the public school system as it stands right now.
Thanks, Megan.
Well, that's a interesting point, because who's requiring all the testing in the public schools with the legislature? So
that is the great irony of we're going to take our students out of a public school because they're just focusing on testing and put them in a charter school. The entire point of all that.
But the backlash to the standardized testing is intense. I mean,
it's real. But I say that's requirements put on those public schools by the legislature.
It's not like the public schools are clamoring for more testing. Yeah.
And I think Seaside, though, with the Waldorf method, is one of those schools, though, that is doing something really different, where parents, it is a much different option than just a charter school that is just another school. The school board unanimously approved Seaside's expansion last year, and they were all pretty excited about it.
Here's an email from Daniel. The county keeps records of when students leave for charter schools and when they come back. I taught in a middle school, and every year many students would leave. We'd lose that funding. Then later in the year, those same kids would come back. Public schools are now responsible for those students who have been doing nothing in some cases in charter school classrooms for half a year. It seems like parents want to dump their kids and magically get results. And when they don't, they ping-pong them from school to school. We're getting so much feedback on this, but we do have to move on and talk about a few other news and notes from the week. And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. The number to join us is 549-2937. A couple of other headlines. Mayor Curry's pension reform got a mixed review this week from Moody's Investors Service when the bond rating agency gave its assessment. Now, Now, Moody's likes Jacksonville stopping pensions for employees hired after September 30th and moving them to 401k-style plans. But the Times Union also reports Moody says the city's pay less now, pay more later approach to fully funding pension obligations means Jacksonville's unfunded pension liability is just going to keep growing. Even after the voter-approved half-cent sales tax for pension costs starts around the year 2031. Ron Littlepage.
I found this very interesting. You may remember Mayor Curry criticized those who said this was kicking down the can down the road, that they were chirping. I guess now Moody's has joined that course of chirpers.
Tim Gibbons.
When I read the Moody's report, I actually thought Ron had written it. It has the exact same sort of criticism that had been leveled, which is clearly if you are concerned about financial stability, having a defined contribution plan rather than a defined benefit plan gives you that stability. You know how much you're going to contribute every time. It's not going to vary. But this pushes out that half-cent sales tax far into the future, and one of the things that Moody's said is it cuts back on the potential of what else can be invested in. If we wanted to do another Better Jacksonville plan, we couldn't do it. And that is the type of thing that Moody's was referring to, that it limits a revenue stream for the city.
Yesterday, A.G. Gankarski asked the mayor about this at the factory opening we were at. But anyway, Curry basically said that he's comfortable with the pension plan. It's all been out in the public. The council
unanimously approved it.
They understood everything. He's passed it. Let's move on. I don't want to talk. You know, this is done.
Let me take issue with that this has all been out in the public. When voters voted on this, there were no details available. And in fact, Mike Weinstein at a council meeting said, we don't want to confuse the voters. So when the vote was taken, the details weren't out there. And then, so I think he's a little bit off base, but that's just me.
Yeah, and now I'm going to be the cynic here and say that city council merely voted for this so they could get public funding for some projects in their district so that they can look good to their constituents and win their next election. That's my take on it, because it really isn't good for Jacksonville to pay billions of dollars more in order to pay the same pension debt by kicking the can down the road yet again.
And I guess Curry's argument has always been, well, what's your solution then?
And that very much has been the argument of Alvin Brown tried to get it through, couldn't get it done for, you know, partially political reasons, partially just because he couldn't get the type of energy that Curry got behind his idea. But if once you say pensions have to change and this is the only plan on the table, there's a certain amount of, well, okay, might not be the best idea, but we got to do something.
Right. All right, let's also talk quickly about a new report that says Hunter Harrison, the new CEO at CSX, has an undisclosed medical condition that requires him to use oxygen and work from home. The 72-year-old Harrison told the Wall Street Journal that doctors have given him the okay to work from home and that his board members at CSX are aware of this. Tim Gibbons, what does this bode for CSX?
A lot of confusion and a lot of people not entirely sure what will happen to a stock price that has been riding at basically historic highs. Hunter Harrison, greatly viewed as somebody who can come in and make the railroad much more efficient, in part by laying people off. But shareholders are very in favor of this. So he would come in, he'd get a huge pay package. And the question is, well, how long will he be able to actually do the job? He retired once, basically got pulled out of retirement to go to a Canadian railroad and turn that one around. He is 72. And, you know, people get older, they have health issues.
That's a serious health issue if he has to work
if he's on oxygen, yes.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, he says that he only uses it sometimes. You know, he has a cough and he'll take the oxygen and it will go away. He did refuse to have a medical examination before getting the CEO's job. It's not atypical for, you know, Fortune 500 company wants to have their doctors.
Especially if you're 70 plus.
Right. And part of the negotiations.
Hold on now. Let's get off the 70.
You know, if you're just old and decrepit. You know,
sorry, I didn't mean to sound ageist with that observation. No, but I mean, how is this going to affect a Fortune 500 company right here in our area?
And it's a big question because basically so Michael Ward was looking to retire. The hedge fund and Harrison, who came in and did this, somewhat forced him out slightly earlier than expected. There was a succession plan in place, but it's somewhat up in the air of if either shareholders don't vote to have Harrison come in, or if he gets sicker and has to step down for medical reasons, it definitely throws a wrench into the tracks,
right,
so to speak.
All right. And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here is only in Florida. And only in Florida does a woman lift the lid on her toilet to find an iguana inside. You wouldn't want to really see that, would you? I wouldn't. This happened in Miami. Fire and rescue had to use gloves to lift the iguana from the bowl and carefully drive it to a rescue center. They think it came up right through the plumbing pipes.
Yeah. At least it wasn't a gator.
Now, this is only in Florida, the critter edition, because only in Florida does a man try to kiss a rattlesnake only to have it bite him on the tongue. Yeah. Putnam County resident Ron Reinold had to be life-flighted to the hospital in critical condition after the rattler's bite on Tuesday. It does appear he is going to make it. He almost died. Reinold bragged to friends that he could kiss the devil and get away with it.
Hey, what type of brag is that?
You can always count on Florida Man to do the dumb, stupid, crazy thing. I never, ever run out of material.
That implies that he did it before, though.
Yeah, West Virginia Church. Haven't you been?
Thanks to our panel, Lindsay Kilbride, Tim Gibbons, Ron Littlepage, and Claire Goforth. Have a great weekend. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
We'll be right back.
The Florida Theater presents direct from the NPR show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Author and comedian Paula Poundstone, February 16th. For more info, floridatheater.com. The Florida Theater is sponsored by Community First Credit Union. The Chartrand Foundation is proud to support the Jacksonville Public Education Fund's efforts to acknowledge and recognize Duval County teachers. To learn more about JPEF's teacher recognition programs, jaxpef.org. Florida Division of Emergency Management. The 2017 hurricane season begins June 1st. All Floridians should be prepared and have a disaster supply kit with everything you'll need for 72 hours. Details at floridadisaster.org.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Metro Rooter specializes in residential plumbing, including tub, faucet, and toilet repairs and replacement. Emergency plumbing 7 days a week with Saturdays considered the same as weekdays. Proud of their many longtime employees, Metro Rooter also recycles for a healthier planet. MetroRooter.com. The Florida Theater presents direct from the NPR show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Author and comedian Paula Poundstone, February 16th. For more info, floridatheater.com. The Florida Theater is sponsored by Community First Credit Union.
Welcome back. Well, today is Bike to Work Day around the country. Here on the First Coast, it's especially important as activists encourage everyone to explore alternatives to car travel. There's an urgency to this because Jacksonville recently made it onto the top four in the nation of large cities with the highest number of pedestrian fatalities. In fact, Florida outranks any other state in the number of pedestrians killed by cars. With more about Bike to Work Day, we welcome attorney Chris Burns. He is the new chairman of the Jacksonville Bicycle Pedestrian Advisory Committee. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us, Amy Ingalls. She's the bike and pedestrian coordinator for the city of Jacksonville. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Chris, let's start with you. We don't have a good track record in Jacksonville or in Florida when it comes to this. Our built environment isn't set up for it. So is it a bit of a challenge to encourage people to bike to work?
You're absolutely right, Melissa. Jacksonville is a very unsafe place to walk or ride a bike. Of the 50 biggest cities in the United States, Jacksonville was ranked as the worst city in the whole United States for combined pedestrian and bicycling death rate. Jacksonville was the worst city for bicycle deaths. And you mentioned that there is a study called Dangerous by Designs that ranked Jacksonville as the fourth worst city in the U.S. for pedestrian danger. Interestingly and sadly, as a Florida resident, Fort Myers, Melbourne, Orlando, Jacksonville, Daytona Beach, Lakeland, and Tampa are the seven worst cities in the United States for pedestrian danger.
Not good. So, Amy Ingalls, what is the city doing to remedy this? And how hard is it to convince people to get out and bike or walk if they feel it's not safe?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll take the first part of that question.
Okay,
first.
A two-part question.
Sure. So right now the city is about to wrap up its bicycle pedestrian master plan study, which has been going on for about the last 2 years. We hired a consultant, arguably the top consultant in the country for this type of stuff, Tool Design Group, and they did a bunch of analysis looking at where people are biking and walking, looking at crash reports, talking to the community, and came up with a whole host of recommendations. Some are infrastructure. Some would be revamping streets completely. Some would be just, you know, filling in pieces of sidewalk where we don't have them. But we're coming out with a plan probably at the end of the month. We should have a final draft. And we'll be I'll be making lots of rounds to community groups and presenting on the results.
Very nice. And as you work on that piece of it, just the framework of our whole city, what's your message for people that they might want to bike more often, but they're hesitant or it's just not part of their routine?
Well, Jacksonville is a very, very big city, as we all know, according to landmass. And it's very varied. Depending on what neighborhood you're in, it may or may not be safe for you to just walk down your street or across the street. So there are places in the city of Jacksonville that are much safer to bike or walk, and others that are much more dangerous. So I would, you know, I would reach out to me or to someone in the bike community, such as Chris or the North Florida Bike Club, and, you know, talk about routes and things like that if you're not really sure where to ride or how to ride.
Sure.
Or where it's safe to walk.
Here's an email for both of you from Mark. The new bike pedestrian master plan does not address significant parts of Jacksonville, only mobility zones 7 through 10. Given that, what assurances do we have that the mayor and city council will follow through on the recommendations in the plan? Or will it be just another report and list of projects? Chris.
Well, that's a very, very good question. The plan is limited to certain mobility zones, but the city has committed itself to extending what was found in the plan with its own staff to being involved in the other mobility zones as well. As a citizen, it's important to be an activist and to advocate for change. We certainly need change. We have more city support now in government than we ever have, but we still have a very long way to go.
Yeah. So concrete steps people can take are just by their actions. That's the whole point of Bike to Work Day.
Yeah, absolutely. Getting involved and understanding what the challenges are in your neighborhood. And just to kind of piggyback on the question that Chris just answered, one of the main components of the master plan was to create a decision-making process for the city to identify and prioritize projects for pedestrians and bicyclists. So that's it. That process is meant to be replicated in the other mobility zones.
Okay, so where can people go to learn more about this and Bike to Work Day?
We have a website just for the master plan. It's www.cojpedbike.com.
And did you bike to work today?
I did. Almost every day.
Almost every day. Oh, you're really living your values. She's Amy Ingalls, the bike pedestrian coordinator for the city of Jacksonville. Chris Burns chairs the Jacksonville Bicycle Pedestrian Advisory Committee. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
The Florida Theater presents direct from the NPR show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Author and comedian Paula Poundstone, February 16th. For more info, floridatheater.com. The Florida Theater is sponsored by Community First Credit Union. The Chartrand Foundation is proud to support the Jacksonville Public Education Fund, powering the potential of our city's students and citizens. Learn more about how you can impact public education at jaxpef.org. Florida Division of Emergency Management and its Get a Plan mobile app, helping all Floridians prepare for the 2017 hurricane season. The Get a Plan app is available at the Apple App Store and Google Play. Metro Rooter specializes in residential plumbing, including tub, faucet, and toilet repairs and replacement. Emergency plumbing 7 days a week, with Saturdays considered the same as weekdays. Proud of their many longtime employees, Metro Rooter also recycles for a healthier planet. MetroRooter.com.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, local artist Jeffrey Lukey is a resident artist in the Cork Arts District. He's also the 2015 second place winner of WJCT's The Square contest, focusing on local art and culture. Now, Lukey has an opening tonight with a very interesting feature. He's going to raffle off one of his paintings, a great opportunity for any art collector. Jeffrey Lukey, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Well, Melissa, thank you so very much for having me. Allow me to speak a little bit about me, myself, and my art and my show that's coming up. It's a series that I've been working on over the past couple of years. I started it at Cork, and I'm so glad that I'm going to have a big show there for everybody to see about this long, hard work and process that I've been working on.
And this is coming up tonight. It's a Girl with Flowers series. These are really beautiful works. Can you literally paint a picture in people's minds that are listening, and what will people see?
Well, the main purpose of this series is I wanted to work on more about working on my technique. So I started a process. So I wanted to do 12 larger than life portraits. Each one is 6 feet tall and 5 feet wide. As a viewer sees it from a distance, it definitely looks like a portrait. And as you get closer and closer and closer, you start looking into the small details that brings out what creates it. So I wanted to give the viewer different aspects as they walk into closer to the painting and farther away from it.
You're also a bicycle mechanic. It's kind of cool to have
yes.
you here on Bike
mm-hmm.
to Work Day.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I wrench on bikes 4 days a week.
And paint on the fifth?
And then we'll paint and pretty much paint every night after work and then every day.
Now, at your opening tonight, you're going to do something a little extra. You're going to have a free raffle mm-hmm. for one of your paintings.
Yeah, so everybody that comes to it, they're going to get a raffle ticket. And also, everybody that registers on the Eventbrite site and comes to it, they're going to get an extra raffle ticket. And one of my flower paintings, one of my smaller ones, and it's I think it's about 4 feet by 3 feet. I'm going to raffle one of those off.
So that's still a pretty significant mm-hmm. piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and these are large-scale paintings overall, and
yes.
they're stunningly beautiful, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you so very much.
They're gorgeous. And so what inspired this series? Because you see this beautiful girl with basically a headdress of flowers.
Well, the main thing is, like, with it is that I wanted to create, I just wanted to create beautiful portraits, and then I enjoy painting flowers, so wanted to use the flowers to help accentuate and make the portrait more beautiful.
And you're a resident in the Cork Arts District in Riverside.
Yes.
What are your thoughts about the Cork District and how it's supporting art and culture in our area?
I think the most important thing about Cork Arts District is that it gives artists like me and other artists our own little special place to create and to be around, because it is a working studio, so it's not always accessible to the public. So for me as being an artist, it's a very special place for me to be able to create work, and I think it definitely allows me to work a lot stronger and take away a lot of inhibitions and be able to work as big as I want to.
It will be open to the public tonight for your opening. You have to be present to win. I'm getting tweets about that. Is
yes,
that right?
Yes, you have to be present.
You want everyone to come out to the Cork East Gallery tonight at 5 o'clock for this gallery opening with the raffle. Pretty awesome. Jeffrey Lukey, bicycle mechanic and artist in the Cork Arts District. It's so good to meet you. And thanks so much for being with us. Have fun.
Oh, thank you so much.
By the way, you can check out Lukey's work. He is the 2015 second place winner in WJCT's The Square. Go to wjct.org/thesquare to search that video. And that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Ryan Bank is running the board today. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Have questions or comments? Emails are always welcome. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And never miss a show. Listen to us through the WJCT app or on iTunes. Up next on 1A, the weekly news roundup. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.